The device of King Henry the Seventh, says Bacon in his Essays Civil and Moral, Essay 29, was profound and admirable, in making farms and houses of husbandry of a standard that is maintained with such a proportion of land unto them as may breed a subject to live in convenient plenty and no servile condition, and to keep the plough in the hands of the owners and not mere hirelings. Footnote. Bacon shows the connection between a free, well-to-do peasantry and good infantry. This did wonderfully concern the might and mannerhood of the kingdom to have farms, as it were, of a standard sufficient to maintain an able body out of penury, and did in effect amortize a great part of the lands of the kingdom under the hold and occupation of the yeomanry or middle people, of a condition between gentlemen and cottagers and peasants. For it hath been held by the general opinion of men of best judgment in the wars that the principal strength of an army consisteth in the infantry or foot. And to make good infantry, it requireth men bred not in a servile or indigent fashion, but in some free and plentiful manner. Therefore, if a state run most to noblemen and gentlemen, and that the husbandmen and ploughmen be but as their workfolk and labourers, or else mere cottagers, which are but housed beggars, you may have a good cavalry, but never good stable bands of foot. And this is to be seen in France and Italy and some other parts abroad, where in effect all is noblesse or peasantry, insomuch that they are enforced to employ mercenary bands of Switzers and the like for their battalions of foot, whereby also it comes to pass that those nations have much people and few soldiers. The Reign of Henry the Seventh, verbatim reprint from Kennett's England, 1870, end of footnote. What the capitalist system demanded was, on the other hand, a degraded and almost servile condition of the mass of the people, the transformation of them into mercenaries, and of their means of labour into capital. During this transformation period, legislation also strove to retain the 4 acres of land by the cottage of the agricultural wage labourer, and forbade him to take lodgers into his cottage. In the reign of James the First, 1627, Roger Crocker of Front Mill was condemned for having built a cottage on the manor of Front Mill without 4 acres of land attached to the same in perpetuity. As late as Charles the First's reign, 1638, a royal commission was appointed to enforce the carrying out of the old laws, especially that referring to the 4 acres of land. Even in Cromwell's time, the building of a house within 4 miles of London was forbidden unless it was endowed with 4 acres of land. As late as the first half of the 18th century, complaint is made if the cottage of the agricultural labourer has not an adjunct of 1 or 2 acres of land. Nowadays he is lucky if it is furnished with a little garden, or if he may rent, far away from his cottage, a few roods. Landlords and farmers, says Dr. Hunter, work here hand in hand. A few acres to the cottage would make the labourers too independent. Footnote. Dr. Hunter, the quantity of land assigned in the old laws would now be judged too great for labourers, and rather as likely to convert them into small farmers. George Roberts, The Social History of the People of the Southern Counties of England in Past Centuries, 1856, end of footnote. The process of forcible expropriation of the people received in the 16th century a new and frightful impulse from the Reformation and from the consequent colossal spoliation of the church property. The Catholic Church was, at the time of the Reformation, feudal proprietor of a great part of the English land. The suppression of the monasteries, etc., hurled their inmates into the proletariat. The estates of the church were, to a large extent, given away to rapacious royal favourites, or sold at a nominal price to speculating farmers and citizens, who drove out en masse the hereditary subtenants and threw their holdings into one. The legally guaranteed property of the poorer folk in a part of the church's tithes was tacitly confiscated. Footnote: the right of the poor to share in the tithe is established by the tenor of ancient statutes. Tuckett. End of footnote. Pauper ubique jacet, the pauper is everywhere subdued, cried Queen Elizabeth after a journey through England. In the 43rd year of her reign, the nation was obliged to recognise pauperism officially by the introduction of a poor rate. The authors of this law seem to have been ashamed to state the grounds of it, for, contrary to traditional usage, it has no preamble whatever. Footnote: William Cobbett, A History of the Protestant Reformation. End of footnote. By the 16th year of Charles I, it was declared perpetual, and in fact only in 1834 did it take a new and harsher form. Footnote: the spirit of Protestantism may be seen from the following, among other things. In the south of England, certain landed proprietors and well-to-do farmers put their heads together and propounded 10 questions as to the right interpretation of the poor law of Elizabeth. These they laid before a celebrated jurist of that time, Sergeant Snigg, later a judge under James I, for his opinion. Question 9. Some of the more wealthy farmers in the parish have devised a skilful mode by which all the trouble of executing this act, the 43rd of Elizabeth, might be avoided. They have proposed that we shall erect a prison in the parish, and then give notice to the neighbourhood that if any persons are disposed to farm the poor of this parish, they do give in sealed proposals on a certain day of the lowest price at which they will take them off our hands, and that they will be authorised to refuse to anyone unless he be shut up in the aforesaid prison. The proposers of this plan conceive that there will be found in the adjoining counties persons who, being unwilling to labour and not possessing substance or credit to take a farm or ship so as to live without labour, may be induced to make a very advantageous offer to the parish. If any of the poor perish under the contractor's care, the sin will lie at his door, as the parish will have done its duty by them. We are, however, apprehensive that the present Act, 43rd of Elizabeth, will not warrant a prudential measure of this kind, but you are to learn that the rest of the freeholders of the county, and of the adjoining county of B, will very readily join in instructing their members to propose an act to enable the parish to contract with a person to lock up and work the poor, and to declare that if any person shall refuse to be so locked up and worked, he shall be entitled to no relief. This, it is hoped, will prevent persons in distress from wanting relief, and be the means of keeping down parishes. R. Blakey, The History of Political Literature from the Earliest Times, 1855. In Scotland, the abolition of serfdom took place some centuries later than in England. Even in 1698, Fletcher of Saltoun declared in the Scotch Parliament, "The number of beggars in Scotland is reckoned at not less than 200,000. The only remedy that I, a republican on principle, can suggest is to restore the old state of serfdom, to make slaves of all those who are unable to provide for their own subsistence." Eden says, "The decrease of villainage seems necessarily to have been the era of the origin of the poor. Manufactures and commerce are the two parents of our national poor." Eden, like our Scotch republican on principle, errs only in this, not the abolition of villainage, but the abolition of the property of the agricultural labourer in the soil, made him a proletarian and eventually a pauper. In France, where the expropriation was effected in another way, the Ordonnance of Moulin, 1571, and the Edict of 1656 correspond to the English poor laws. End of footnote. These immediate results of the Reformation were not its most lasting ones. The property of the church formed the religious bulwark of the traditional conditions of landed property. With its fall, these were no longer tenable. Footnote. Professor Rogers, although formerly Professor of Political Economy in the University of Oxford, the hotbed of Protestant orthodoxy, in his preface to the History of Agriculture, lays stress on the fact of the pauperization of the mass of the people by the Reformation. End of footnote. Even in the last decade of the 17th century, the yeomanry, the class of independent peasants, were more numerous than the class of farmers. They had formed the backbone of Cromwell's strength, and even according to the Confession of Macaulay, stood in favourable contrast to the drunken squires and to their servants, the country clergy, who had to marry their masters' cast-off mistresses. About 1750, the yeomanry had disappeared, and so had, in the last decade of the 18th century, the last trace of the common land of the agricultural labourer. Footnote. A letter to Sir T.C. Bunbury, Bart., on the high price of provisions, by a Suffolk gentleman, Ipswich, 1795. Even the fanatical advocate of the system of large farms, the author of the Inquiry into the Connection Between the Present Price of Provisions, London, 1773, says, "I most lament the loss of our yeomanry, that set of men who really kept up the independence of this nation, and sorry I am to see their lands now in the hands of monopolizing lords, tenanted out to small farmers, who hold their leases on such conditions as to be little better than vassals ready to attend a summons on every mischievous occasion." End of footnote. We leave on one side here the purely economic causes of the agricultural revolution. We deal only with the forcible means employed. After the restoration of the Stuarts, the landed proprietors carried, by legal means, an act of usurpation, effected everywhere on the continent without any legal formality. They abolished the feudal tenure of land, that is, they got rid of all its obligations to the state, indemnified the state by taxes on the peasantry and the rest of the mass of the people, vindicated for themselves the rights of modern private property in estates to which they had only a feudal title, and, finally, passed those laws of settlement which, mutatis mutandis, had the same effect on the English agricultural labourer as the edict of the Tartar Boris Godunov on the Russian peasantry. The glorious revolution brought into power, along with William of Orange, the landlord and capitalist appropriators of surplus value. Footnote. On the private moral character of this bourgeois hero, among other things, the large grant of lands in Ireland to Lady Orkney in 1695 is a public instance of the king's affection and the lady's influence. Lady Orkney's endearing offices are supposed to have been fida labiorum ministeria. In the Sloane manuscript collection at the British Museum, the manuscript is entitled "The Character and Behaviour of King William, Sunderland, etc., as represented in original letters to the Duke of Shrewsbury, from Somers Halifax, Oxford, Secretary Vernon, etc." It is full of curiosa. End of footnote. They inaugurated the new era by practicing on a colossal scale thefts of state lands, thefts that had been hitherto managed more modestly. These estates were given away, sold at ridiculous figure, or even annexed to private estates by direct seizure. Footnote. The illegal alienation of the Crown estates, partly by sale and partly by gift, is a scandalous chapter in English history, a gigantic fraud on the nation. F. W. Newman, Lectures on Political Economy, London, 1851. For details as to how the present large landed proprietors of England came into their possessions, see Our Old Nobility by Noblesse Oblige, London, 1879, Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. All this happened without the slightest observation of legal etiquette. The Crown lands thus fraudulently appropriated, together with the robbery of the church estates, as far as these had not been lost again during the Republican Revolution, form the basis of the today princely domains of the English oligarchy. Footnote. Read, for example, E. Burke's pamphlet on the Ducal House of Bedford, whose offshoot was Lord John Russell, the tomtit of liberalism. End of footnote. The bourgeois capitalists favoured the operation with the view, among others, to promoting free trade in land, to extending the domain of modern agriculture on the large farm system, and to increasing their supply of the free agricultural proletarians ready to hand. Besides, the new landed aristocracy was the natural ally of the new bankocracy, of the newly hatched haute finance, and of the large manufacturers, then depending on protective duties. The English bourgeoisie acted for its own interest quite as wisely as did the Swedish bourgeoisie, who, reversing the process, hand in hand with their economic allies, the peasantry, helped the kings in the forcible resumption of the crown lands from the oligarchy. This happened since 1604 under Charles X and Charles XI. Communal property, always distinct from the state property just dealt with, was an old Teutonic institution which lived on under cover of feudalism. We have seen how the forcible usurpation of this, generally accompanied by the turning of arable into pasture land, begins at the end of the 15th and extends into the 16th century. But at that time, the process was carried on by means of individual acts of violence against which legislation for 150 years fought in vain. The advance made by the 18th century shows itself in this, that the law itself becomes now the instrument of the theft of the people's land. Although the large farmers make use of their little independent methods as well. Footnote. The farmers forbid cottagers to keep any living creatures, besides themselves and children, under the pretense that if they keep any beasts or poultry, they will steal from the farmers' barns for their support. They also say, keep the cottagers poor, and you will keep them industrious, etc. But the real fact, I believe, is that the farmers may have the whole right of common to themselves. A Political Inquiry into the Consequences of Enclosing Waste Lands, 1785, end of footnote. The parliamentary form of the robbery is that of Acts for Enclosures of Commons. In other words, decrees by which the landlords grant themselves the people's land as private property, decrees of expropriation of the people. Sir F. M. Eden refutes his own crafty special pleading, in which he tries to represent communal property as the private property of the great landlords who have taken the place of the feudal lords, when he himself demands a general act of Parliament for the enclosure of commons, admitting thereby that a parliamentary coup d'état is necessary for its transformation into private property, and moreover calls on the legislature for the indemnification for the expropriated poor. Whilst the place of the independent yeoman was taken by tenants at will, small farmers on yearly leases, a servile rabble dependent on the pleasure of the landlords, the systematic robbery of the communal lands helped especially, next to the theft of the state domains, to swell those large farms that were called in the 18th century capital farms or merchant farms, and to set free the agricultural population as proletarians for manufacturing industry. Footnote. Capital farms, two letters on the flour trade and the dearness of corn, by a person in business, London, 1767. Merchant farms, an inquiry into the causes of the present high price of provisions, London, 1767. This excellent work, that was published anonymously, is by the Reverend Nathaniel Forster. End of footnote. The 18th century, however, did not yet recognise as fully as the 19th the identity between national wealth and the poverty of the people. Hence, the most vigorous polemic in the economic literature of that time on the enclosure of commons. From the mass of materials that lie before me, I give a few extracts that will throw a strong light on the circumstances of the time. In several parishes of Hertfordshire, writes one indignant person, 24 farms, numbering on the average 50 to 150 acres, have been melted up into three farms. Footnote. Thomas Wright, A Short Address to the Public on the Monopoly of Large Farms, 1779. In Northamptonshire and Leicestershire, the enclosure of common lands has taken place on a very large scale, and most of the new lordships resulting from the enclosure have been turned into pasturage, in consequence of which many lordships have not now 50 acres ploughed yearly, in which 1,500 were ploughed formerly. The ruins of former dwelling-houses, barns, stables, etc., are the sole traces of the former inhabitants. 100 houses and families have in some open-field villages dwindled to 8 or 10. The landholders in most parishes that have been enclosed, only 15 or 20 years, are very few in comparison of the numbers who occupied them in their open-field state. It is no uncommon thing for 4 or 5 wealthy graziers to engross a large enclosed lordship which was before in the hands of 20 or 30 farmers, and as many smaller tenants and proprietors. All these are hereby thrown out of their livings with their families, and many other families who were chiefly employed and supported by them. Footnote. Reverend Addington, Inquiry into the Reasons for or Against Enclosing Open Fields, London, 1772. End of footnote. It was not only the land that lay waste, but often land cultivated either in common or held under a definite rent paid to the community that was annexed by the neighbouring landlords under pretext of enclosure. I have here in view enclosures of open fields and lands already improved. It is acknowledged by even the writers in defence of enclosures that these diminished villages increase the monopolies of farms, raise the prices of provisions, and produce depopulation, and even the enclosure of wastelands, as now carried on, bears hard on the poor, by depriving them of a part of their subsistence, and only goes towards increasing farms already too large. Footnote. Dr. R. Price, Forster, Addington, Kent, Price, and James Anderson should be read and compared with the miserable prattle of sycophant McCulloch in his catalogue, The Literature of Political Economy, London, 1845. End of footnote. When, says Dr. Price, this land gets into the hands of a few great farmers, the consequence must be that the little farmers, earlier designated by him a multitude of little proprietors and tenants, who maintain themselves and families by the produce of the ground they occupy, by sheep kept on a common, by poultry, hogs, etc., and who therefore have little occasion to purchase any of the means of subsistence, will be converted into a body of men who earn their subsistence by working for others, and who will be under a necessity of going to market for all they want. There will perhaps be more labour, because there will be more compulsion to it. Towns and manufactures will increase, because more will be driven to them in quest of places and employment. This is the way in which the engrossing of farms naturally operates, and this is the way in which, for many years, it has been actually operating in this kingdom. He sums up the effect of the enclosures thus. Upon the whole, the circumstances of the lower ranks of men are altered in almost every respect for the worse. From little occupiers of land, they are reduced to the state of day labourers and hirelings, and at the same time, their subsistence in that state has become more difficult. Footnote. Price. We are reminded of ancient Rome. The rich had got possession of the greater part of the undivided land. They trusted in the conditions of the time that these possessions would not be again taken from them, and bought, therefore, some of the pieces of land lying near theirs, and belonging to the poor, with the acquiescence of their owners, and took some by force, so that they now were cultivating widely extended domains instead of isolated fields. Then they employed slaves in agriculture and cattle breeding, because freemen would have been taken from labour for military service. The possession of slaves brought them great gain, inasmuch as these, on account of their immunity from military service, could freely multiply and have a multitude of children. Thus the powerful men drew all wealth to themselves, and all the land swarmed with slaves. The Italians, on the other hand, were always decreasing in number, destroyed as they were by poverty, taxes, and military service. Even when times of peace came, they were doomed to complete inactivity, because the rich were in possession of the soil, and used slaves instead of freemen in the tilling of it. Appian, Civil Wars. This passage refers to the time before the Licinian Rogations. Military service, which hastened to so great an extent the ruin of the Roman plebeians, was also the chief means by which, as in a forcing house, Charlemagne brought about the transformation of free German peasants into serfs and bondsmen. End of footnote. In fact, usurpation of the common lands and the revolution in agriculture accompanying this told so acutely on the agricultural labourers that, even according to Eden, between 1765 and 1780, their wages began to fall below the minimum and to be supplemented by official poor law relief. Their wages, he says, were not more than enough for the absolute necessaries of life. Let us hear for a moment a defender of enclosures and an opponent of Dr. Price. Not is it a consequence that there must be depopulation, because men are not seen wasting their labour in the open field. If, by converting the little farmers into a body of men who must work for others, more labour is produced, it is an advantage which the nation, to which, of course, the converted ones do not belong, should wish for. The produce being greater when their joint labours are employed on one farm, there will be a surplus for manufactures, and by this means manufactures, one of the mines of the nation, will increase in proportion to the quantity of corn produced. Footnote. An inquiry into the connection between the present price of provisions, etc. To the like effect, but with an opposite tendency, working men are driven from their cottages and forced into the towns to seek for employment. But then a larger surplus is obtained, and thus capital is augmented. The Perils of the Nation, 1843, end of footnote. The stoical peace of mind with which the political economist regards the most shameless violation of the sacred rights of property and the grossest acts of violence to persons as soon as they are necessary to lay the foundations of the capitalistic mode of production is shown by Sir F. M. Eden, philanthropist and Tory to boot. The whole series of thefts, outrages, and popular misery that accompanied the forcible expropriation of the people from the last third of the 15th to the end of the 18th century lead him merely to the comfortable conclusion, "The due proportion between arable land and pasture had to be established. During the whole of the 14th and the greater part of the 15th century, there was 1 acre of pasture to 2, 3, and even 4 of arable land. About the middle of the 16th century, the proportion was changed of 2 acres of pasture to 2, later on of 2 acres of pasture to 1 of arable, until at last the just proportion of 3 acres of pasture to 1 of arable land was attained." In the 19th century, the very memory of the connection between the agricultural labourer and the communal property had, of course, vanished. To say nothing of more recent times, have the agricultural population received a farthing of compensation for the 3,511,770 acres of common land which between 1801 and 1831 were stolen from them, and by parliamentary devices presented to the landlords, by the landlords? The last process of wholesale expropriation of the agricultural population from the soil is, finally, the so-called clearing of estates, that is, the sweeping men off them. All the English methods hitherto considered culminated in clearing. As we saw in the picture of modern conditions given in a former chapter, where there are no more independent peasants to get rid of, the clearing of cottages begins. So that the agricultural labourers do not find on the soil cultivated by them even the spot necessary for their own housing. But what clearing of estates really and properly signifies, we learn only in the promised land of modern romance, the Highlands of Scotland. There the process is distinguished by its systematic character, by the magnitude of the scale on which it is carried out at one blow. In Ireland, landlords have gone to the length of sweeping away several villages at once. In Scotland, areas as large as German principalities are dealt with. Finally, by the peculiar form of property under which the embezzled lands were held. The Highland Celts were organized in clans, each of which was the owner of the land on which it was settled. The representative of the clan, its chief or great man, was only the titular owner of this property, just as the Queen of England is the titular owner of all the national soil. When the English government succeeded in suppressing the intestine wars of these great men and their constant incursions into the lowland plains, the chiefs of the clans by no means gave up their time-honoured trade as robbers. They only changed its form. On their own authority, they transformed their nominal right into a right of private property, and as this brought them into collision with their clansmen, resolved to drive them out by open force. A king of England might as well claim to drive his subjects into the sea, says Professor Newman. This revolution, which began in Scotland after the last rising of the followers of the Pretender, can be followed through its first phases in the writings of Sir James Stuart and James Anderson. Footnote. Stuart says, "If you compare the rent of these lands," he erroneously includes in this economic category the tribute of the taskmen to the clan chief. With the extent, it appears very small. If you compare it with the numbers fed upon the farm, you will find that an estate in the Highlands maintains perhaps 10 times as many people as another of the same value in a good and fertile province. James Anderson, Observations on the Means of Exciting a Spirit of National Industry, etc., Edinburgh, 1777. In the 18th century, the hunted-out Gaels were forbidden to emigrate from the country, with a view to driving them by force to Glasgow and other manufacturing towns. Footnote. In 1860, the people expropriated by force were exported to Canada under false pretences. Some fled to the mountains and neighbouring islands. They were followed by the police, came to blows with them, and escaped. In the Highlands of Scotland, says Buchanan, the commentator on Adam Smith, 1814, the ancient state of property is daily subverted. The landlord, without regard to the hereditary tenant, a category used in error here, now offers his land to the highest bidder, who, if he is an improver, instantly adopts a new system of cultivation. The land, formerly overspread with small tenants or labourers, was peopled in proportion to its produce, but under the new system of improved cultivation and increased rents, the largest possible produce is obtained at the least possible expense, and the useless hands being, with this view, removed, the population is reduced, not to what the land will maintain, but to what it will employ. The dispossessed tenants either seek a subsistence in the neighbouring towns, etc., David Buchanan, Observations on, etc., A. Smith's Wealth of Nations, Edinburgh, 1814. The Scotch grandees dispossessed families as they would grub up coppice wood, and they treated villages and their people as Indians harassed with wild beasts do in their vengeance, a jungle with tigers. Man is bartered for a fleece or a carcass of mutton, nay, held cheaper. Why, how much worse is it than the intention of the Moguls, who, when they had broken into the northern provinces of China, proposed in council to exterminate the inhabitants and convert the land into pasture. This proposal many Highland proprietors have effected in their own country, against their own countrymen. George Ensor, An Inquiry Concerning the Population of Nations. End of footnote. As an example of this method obtaining in the 19th century, the clearing made by the Duchess of Sutherland will suffice here. This person, well instructed in economy, resolved on entering upon her government to effect a radical cure and to turn the whole country, whose population had already been by earlier processes of the like kind reduced to 15,000, into a sheep walk. From 1814 to 1820, these 15,000 inhabitants, about 3,000 families, were systematically hunted and rooted out. All their villages were destroyed and burnt, all their fields turned to pasturage. British soldiers enforced this eviction and came to blows with the inhabitants. One old woman was burnt to death in the flames of the hut which she refused to leave. Thus this fine lady appropriated 794,000 acres of land that had from time immemorial belonged to the clan. She assigned to the expelled inhabitants about 6,000 acres on the seashore, 2 acres per family. The 6,000 acres had until this time lain waste and brought in no income to their owners. The Duchess, in the nobility of her heart, actually went so far as to let these, at an average rent of 2 shillings and 6 pence per acre, to the clansmen, who for centuries had shed their blood for her family. The whole of the stolen clan land she divided into 29 great sheep farms, each inhabited by a single family, for the most part imported English farm servants. In the year 1835, the 15,000 Gaels were already replaced by 131,000 sheep. The remnant of the Aborigines, flung on the seashore, tried to live by catching fish. They became amphibious and lived, as an English author says, half on land and half on water, and withal only half on both. Footnote. When the present Duchess of Sutherland entertained Mrs. Beecher Stowe, authoress of Uncle Tom's Cabin, with great magnificence in London, to show her sympathy for the negro slaves of the American Republic, a sympathy that she prudently forgot with her fellow aristocrats during the Civil War, in which every noble English heart beat for the slave owner, I gave in the New York Tribune the facts about the Sutherland slaves, epitomized in part by Carey in The Slave Trade, Philadelphia, 1853. My article was reprinted in a Scotch newspaper and led to a pretty polemic between the latter and the sycophants of the Sutherlands. End of footnote. But the brave Gaels must expiate yet more bitterly their idolatry, romantic and of the mountains, for the great men of the clan. The smell of their fish rose to the noses of the great men. They scented some profit in it, and let the seashore to the great fishmongers of London. For the second time, the Gaels were hunted out. Footnote. Interesting details on this fish trade will be found in Mr. David Urquhart's portfolio, New Series. Nassau W. Senior, in his posthumous work already quoted, terms the proceedings in Sutherlandshire one of the most beneficent clearings since the memory of man. End of footnote. But finally, part of the sheep walks are turned into deer preserves. Everyone knows that there are no real forests in England. The deer in the parks of the great are demurely domestic cattle, fat as London aldermen. Scotland is, therefore, the last refuge of the noble passion. In the Highlands, says Somers in 1848, new forests are springing up like mushrooms. Here, on one side of Gaec, you have the new forest of Glenfeshy, and there on the other you have the new forest of Arvernechy. In the same line you have the Black Mount, an immense waste also recently erected. From east to west, from the neighbourhood of Aberdeen to the crags of Oban, you have now a continuous line of forests, while in other parts of the Highlands there are the new forests of Loch Arkaig, Glengarry, Glenmoriston, etc. Sheep were introduced into glens, which had been the seats of communities of small farmers, and the latter were driven to seek subsistence on coarser and more sterile tracts of soil. Now deer are supplanting sheep, and these are once more dispossessing the small tenants, who will necessarily be driven down upon still coarser land and to more grinding penury. Deer forests and the people cannot coexist. Footnote. The deer forests of Scotland contain not a single tree. The sheep are driven from, and then the deer driven to, the naked hills, and then it is called a deer forest. Not even timber planting and real forest culture. End of footnote. One or other of the two must yield. Let the forests be increased in number and extent during the next quarter of a century, as they have been in the last, and the Gaels will perish from their native soil. This movement among the Highland proprietors is with some a matter of ambition, with some love of sport, while others, of a more practical cast, follow the trade in deer with an eye solely to profit. For it is a fact that a mountain range laid out in forest is, in many cases, more profitable to the proprietor than when let as a sheep walk. The huntsman who wants a deer forest limits his offers by no other calculation than the extent of his purse. Sufferings have been inflicted in the Highlands scarcely less severe than those occasioned by the policy of the Norman kings. Deer have received extended ranges, while men have been hunted within a narrower and still narrower circle. One after one, the liberties of the people have been cloven down, and the oppressions are daily on the increase. The clearance and dispersion of the people is pursued by the proprietors as a settled principle, as an agricultural necessity, just as trees and brushwood are cleared from the wastes of America or Australia, and the operation goes on in a quiet, business-like way, etc. Footnote. Robert Summers, Letters from the Highlands, or the Famine of 1847, London, 1848. These letters originally appeared in the Times. The English economists, of course, explained the famine of the Gaels in 1847 by their overpopulation. At all events, they were pressing on their food supply. The clearing of estates, or as it is called in Germany, Bauernlegen, occurred in Germany especially after the Thirty Years' War, and led to peasant revolts, as late as 1790 in Kursachsen. It obtained especially in East Germany. In most of the Prussian provinces, Frederick II for the first time secured right of property for the peasants. After the conquest of Silesia, he forced the landlords to rebuild the huts, barns, etc., and to provide the peasants with cattle and implements. He wanted soldiers for his army and taxpayers for his treasury. For the rest, the pleasant life that the peasant led under Frederick's system of finance and hodgepodge rule of despotism, bureaucracy, and feudalism may be seen from the following quotation from his admirer, Mirabeau. "Flax represents one of the greatest sources of wealth for the peasant of North Germany. Unfortunately for the human race, this is only a resource against misery, and not a means towards well-being. Direct taxes, forced labour service, obligations of all kinds crush the German peasant, especially as he still has to pay indirect taxes on everything he buys. And to complete his ruin, he dare not sell his produce where and as he wishes. He dare not buy what he needs from the merchants who could sell it to him at a cheaper price. He is slowly ruined by all those factors, and when the direct taxes fall due, he would find himself incapable of paying them without his spinning wheel. It offers him a last resort, while providing useful occupation for his wife, his children, his maids, his farmhands, and himself. But what a painful life he leads, even with this extra resource. In summer he works like a convict with the plough and at harvest. He goes to bed at 9 o'clock and rises at 2 to get through all his work. In winter he ought to be recovering his strength by sleeping longer, but he would run short of corn for his bread, and next year's sowing, if he got rid of the products that he needs to sell in order to pay the taxes. He therefore has to spin to fill up this gap, and indeed he must do so most assiduously. Thus the peasant goes to bed at midnight or 1 o'clock in the winter, and gets up at 5 or 6, or he goes to bed at 9 and gets up at 2, and this he does every day of his life except Sundays. These excessively short hours of sleep and long hours of work consume a person's strength, and hence it happens that men and women age much more in the country than in the towns." Mirabeau. Note to the second edition. In April 1866, 18 years after the publication of the quoted work of Robert Summers, Professor Leonie Levi gave a lecture before the Society of Arts on the transformation of sheep walks into deer forest, in which he depicts the advance in the devastation of the Scottish Highlands. He says, with other things, depopulation and transformation into sheep walks were the most convenient means for getting an income without expenditure. A deer forest in place of a sheep walk was a common change in the Highlands. The landowners turned out the sheep as they once turned out the men from their estates and welcomed the new tenants, the wild beasts and the feathered birds. One can walk from the Earl of Dalhousie's estates in Forfarshire to John O'Groats without ever leaving forest land. In many of these woods, the fox, the wildcat, the marten, the polecat, the weasel, and the alpine hare are common, whilst the rabbit, the squirrel, and the rat have lately made their way into the country. Immense tracts of land, much of which is described in the statistical account of Scotland as having a pasturage in richness and extent of very superior description, are thus shut out from all cultivation and improvement, and are solely devoted to the sport of a few persons for a very brief period of the year. The London Economist of June 2, 1866, says, "Amongst the items of news in a Scotch paper of last week, we read, 'One of the finest sheep farms in Sutherlandshire, for which a rent of £1,200 a year was recently offered on the expiry of the existing lease this year, is to be converted into a deer forest.' Here we see the modern instincts of feudalism, operating pretty much as they did when the Norman Conqueror destroyed 36 villages to create the new forest. 2 millions of acres, totally laid waste, embracing within their area some of the most fertile lands of Scotland. The natural grass of Glentilt was among the most nutritive in the county of Perth. The deer forest of Ben Older was by far the best grazing ground in the wide district of Badenoch. A part of the Black Mount Forest was the best pasture for black-faced sheep in Scotland. Some idea of the ground laid waste for purely sporting purposes in Scotland may be formed from the fact that it embraced an area larger than the whole county of Perth. The resources of the Forest of Ben Older might give some idea of the loss sustained from the forced desolations. The ground would pasture 15,000 sheep, and as it was not more than 1/30th part of the old forest ground in Scotland, it might, etc. All that forest land is as totally unproductive. It might thus as well have been submerged under the waters of the German Ocean. Such extemporized wildernesses or deserts ought to be put down by the decided interference of the legislature." End of footnote. The spoliation of the church's property, the fraudulent alienation of the state domains, the robbery of the common lands, the usurpation of feudal and clan property, and its transformation into modern private property under circumstances of reckless terrorism, were just so many idyllic methods of primitive accumulation. They conquered the field for capitalistic agriculture, made the soil part and parcel of capital, and created for the town industries the necessary supply of a, quotes, "free" and outlawed proletariat. Chapter 28. Bloody Legislation Against the Expropriated from the End of the 15th Century. Forcing Down of Wages by Acts of Parliament. The proletariat created by the breaking up of the bands of feudal retainers and by the forcible expropriation of the people from the soil, this free proletariat could not possibly be absorbed by the nascent manufactures as fast as it was thrown upon the world. On the other hand, these men, suddenly dragged from their wonted mode of life, could not as suddenly adapt themselves to the discipline of their new condition. They were turned en masse into beggars, robbers, vagabonds, partly from inclination, in most cases from stress of circumstances. Hence, at the end of the 15th, and during the whole of the 16th century, throughout Western Europe, a bloody legislation against vagabondage. The fathers of the present working class were chastised for their enforced transformation into vagabonds and paupers. Legislation treated them as voluntary criminals, and assumed that it depended on their own good will to go on working under the old conditions that no longer existed. In England, this legislation began under Henry VII. Henry VIII, 1530. Beggars old and unable to work receive a beggar's license. On the other hand, whipping and imprisonment for sturdy vagabonds. They are to be tied to the cart tail and whipped until the blood streams from their bodies, then to swear an oath to go back to their birthplace or to where they have lived the last 3 years and to put themselves to labour. What grim irony! In 27 Henry VIII, the former statute is repeated, but strengthened with new clauses. For the second arrest for vagabondage, the whipping is to be repeated, and half the ear sliced off. But for the third relapse, the offender is to be executed as a hardened criminal and enemy of the common weal. Edward VI. A statute of the first year of his reign, 1547, ordains that if anyone refuses to work, he shall be condemned as a slave to the person who has denounced him as an idler. The master shall feed his slave on bread and water, weak broth, and such refuse meat as he thinks fit. He has the right to force him to do any work, no matter how disgusting, with whip and chains. If the slave is absent a fortnight, he is condemned to slavery for life, and is to be branded on forehead or back with the letter S. If he runs away thrice, he is to be executed as a felon. The master can sell him, bequeath him, let him out on hire as a slave, just as any other personal chattel or cattle. If the slaves attempt anything against the masters, they are also to be executed. Justices of the peace, on information, are to hunt the rascals down. If it happens that a vagabond has been idling about for 3 days, he is to be taken to his birthplace, branded with a red-hot iron with the letter V on the breast, and be set to work in chains in the streets or at some other labour. If the vagabond gives a false birthplace, he is then to become the slave for life of this place, of its inhabitants, or its corporation, and to be branded with an S. All persons have the right to take away the children of the vagabonds and to keep them as apprentices, the young men until the 24th year, the girls until the 20th. If they run away, they are to become, up to this age, the slaves of their masters, who can put them in irons, whip them, etc., if they like. Every master may put an iron ring round the neck, arms, or legs of his slave, by which to know him more easily, and to be more certain of him. Footnote. The author of The Essay on Trade, etc., 1770, says, "In the reign of Edward VI, indeed the English seem to have set in good earnest about encouraging manufactures and employing the poor. This we learn from a remarkable statute which runs thus, that all vagrants shall be branded, etc." End of footnote. The last part of this statute provides that certain poor people may be employed by a place or by persons who are willing to give them food and drink and to find them work. This kind of parish slaves was kept up in England until far into the 19th century under the name of roundsmen. Elizabeth, 1572. Unlicensed beggars above 14 years of age are to be severely flogged and branded on the left ear unless someone will take them into service for 2 years. In case of a repetition of the offence, if they are over 18, they are to be executed, unless someone will take them into service for 2 years. But for the third offence, they are to be executed without mercy, as felons. Similar statutes, 18 Elizabeth, chapter 13, and another of 1597. Footnote. Thomas More says, in his Utopia, "For when an insatiable wretch, who is a plague to his country, resolves to enclose many thousand acres of ground, the owners, as well as tenants, are turned out of their possessions by trick or by main force, or, being wearied out by ill usage, they are forced to sell them, by which means those miserable people, both men and women, married and unmarried, old and young, with their poor but numerous families, since country business requires many hands, are all forced to change their seats, not knowing whither to go, and they must sell, almost for nothing, their household stuff, which could not bring them much money, even though they might stay for a buyer. When that little money is at an end, for it will be soon spent, what is left for them to do but either to steal, and so to be hanged, God knows how justly, or to go about and beg? And if they do this, they are put in prison as idle vagabonds, while they would willingly work, but can find none that will hire them." Of these poor fugitives, of whom Thomas More says that they were forced to thieve, 7,000 great and petty thieves were put to death in the reign of Henry VIII. Holinshed, Description of England, Volume 1. Elizabeth's time, rogues were trussed up apace, and that there was not one year commonly wherein 300 or 400 were not devoured and eaten up by the gallows. Stripes, Annals of the Reformation and Establishment of Religion and other various occurrences in the Church of England during Queen Elizabeth's happy reign, 1725. According to this same Stripe, in Somersetshire in one year 40 persons were executed, 35 robbers burnt in the hand, 37 whipped, and 183 discharged as incorrigible vagabonds. Nevertheless, he is of the opinion that this large number of prisoners does not comprise even a fifth of the actual criminals, thanks to the negligence of the justices and the foolish compassion of the people. And the other counties of England were not better off in this respect than Somersetshire, while some were even worse. End of footnote. James the First. Anyone wandering about and begging is declared a rogue and a vagabond. Justices of the peace in petty sessions are authorised to have them publicly whipped, and for the first offence to imprison them for 6 months, for the second for 2 years. Whilst in prison they are to be whipped as much and as often as the justices of the peace think fit. Incorrigible and dangerous rogues are to be branded with an R on the left shoulder and set to hard labour, and if they are caught begging again, to be executed without mercy. These statutes, legally binding until the beginning of the 18th century, were only repealed by 12 Anne, chapter 23. Similar laws in France, where by the middle of the 17th century a kingdom of vagabonds, truands, was established in Paris. Even at the beginning of Louis the 16th's reign, Ordinance of July the 13th, 1777, every man in good health from 16 to 60 years of age, if without means of subsistence and not practising a trade, is to be sent to the galleys. Of the same nature are the statute of Charles the 5th for the Netherlands, October 1537, the first edict of the States and Towns of Holland, March the 10th, 1614, the Placard of the United Provinces, June the 26th, 1649, etc. Thus were the agricultural people first forcibly expropriated from the soil, driven from their homes, turned into vagabonds, and then whipped, branded, tortured by laws grotesquely terrible into the discipline necessary for the wage system. It is not enough that the conditions of labour are concentrated in a mass, in the shape of capital, at the one pole of society, while at the other are grouped masses of men who have nothing to sell but their labour power. Neither is it enough that they are compelled to sell it voluntarily. The advance of capitalist production develops a working class, which, by education, tradition, habit, looks upon the conditions of that mode of production as self-evident laws of nature. The organization of the capitalist process of production, once fully developed, breaks down all resistance. The constant generation of a relative surplus population keeps the law of supply and demand of labor, and therefore keeps wages in a rut that corresponds with the wants of capital. The dull compulsion of economic relations completes the subjection of the laborer to the capitalist. Direct force outside economic conditions is, of course, still used, but only exceptionally. In the ordinary run of things, the labourer can be left to the natural laws of production, that is, to his dependence on capital, a dependence springing from and guaranteed in perpetuity by the conditions of production themselves. It is otherwise during the historic genesis of capitalist production. The bourgeoisie, at its rise, wants and uses the power of the state to regulate wages, that is, to force them within the limits suitable for surplus value making, to lengthen the working day and to keep the labourer himself in the normal degree of dependence. This is an essential element of the so-called primitive accumulation. The class of wage labourers which arose in the latter half of the 14th century formed then and in the following century only a very small part of the population, well protected in its position by the independent peasant proprietary in the country and the guild organization in the town. In country and town, master and workmen stood close together socially. The subordination of labor to capital was only formal, that is, the mode of production itself had as yet no specific capitalistic character. Variable capital preponderated greatly over constant. The demand for wage labour grew, therefore, rapidly with every accumulation of capital, whilst the supply of wage labour followed but slowly. A large part of the national product changed later into a fund of capitalist accumulation, then still entered into the consumption fund of the labourer. Legislation on wage labour, from the first aimed at the exploitation of the labourer and, as it advanced, always equally hostile to him, is started in England by the Statute of Labourers of Edward III, 1349. The Ordinance of 1350 in France, issued in the name of King John, corresponds with it. Footnote. Whenever the legislature attempts to regulate the differences between masters and their workmen, its counsellors are always the masters, says A. Smith. L'esprit des lois, c'est la propriété, says Langway. End of footnote. English and French legislation run parallel and are identical in purport. So far as the labour statutes aim at compulsory extension of the working day, I do not return to them, as this point was treated earlier. Chapter 10, Section 5. The Statute of Labourers was passed at the urgent instance of the House of Commons. A Tory says naively, "Formerly the poor demanded such high wages as to threaten industry and wealth. Next, their wages are so low as to threaten industry and wealth equally, and perhaps more, but in another way." Footnote. Sophisms of Free Trade by a Barrister, London, 1850. He adds maliciously, "We were ready enough to interfere for the employer. Can nothing now be done for the employed?" End of footnote. A tariff of wages was fixed by law for town and country, for piecework and day work. The agricultural labourers were to hire themselves out by the year, the town ones, in open market. It was forbidden, under pain of imprisonment, to pay higher wages than those fixed by the statute. But the taking of higher wages was more severely punished than the giving them. So also in sections 18 and 19 of the Statute of Apprentices of Elizabeth, 10 days imprisonment is decreed for him that pays the higher wages, but 21 days for him that received them. A statute of 1360 increased the penalties and authorized the masters to extort labour at the legal rate of wages by corporal punishment. All combinations, contracts, oaths, etc., by which masons and carpenters reciprocally bound themselves, were declared null and void. Coalition of the labourers is treated as a heinous crime from the 14th century to 1825, the year of the repeal of the laws against trades unions. The spirit of the Statute of Labourers of 1349 and of its offshoots comes out clearly in the fact that indeed a maximum of wages is dictated by the state, but on no account a minimum. In the 16th century, the condition of the labourers had, as we know, become much worse. The money wage rose, but not in proportion to the depreciation of money and the corresponding rise in the price of commodities. Wages, therefore, in reality, fell. Nevertheless, the laws for keeping them down remained in force, together with the ear-clipping and branding of those whom no one was willing to take into service. By the Statute of Apprentices, 5 Elizabeth, Chapter 3, the justices of the peace were empowered to fix certain wages and to modify them according to the time of the year and the price of the commodities. James I extended these regulations of labour also to weavers, spinners, and all possible categories of workers. Footnote. From a clause of Statute 2, James I, Chapter 6, we see that certain clothmakers took upon themselves to dictate, in their capacity of justices of the peace, the official tariff of wages in their own shops. In Germany, especially after the 30 Years' War, statutes for keeping down wages were general. The want of servants and labourers was very troublesome to the landed proprietors in the depopulated districts. All villagers were forbidden to let rooms to single men and women. All the latter were to be reported to the authorities and cast into prison if they were unwilling to become servants, even if they were employed at any other work, such as sowing seeds for the peasants at a daily wage, or even buying and selling corn. Imperial privileges and sanctions for Silesia. For a whole century, in the decrees of the small German potentates, a bitter cry goes up again and again about the wicked and impertinent rabble that will not reconcile itself to its hard lot, will not be content with the legal wage. The individual landed proprietors are forbidden to pay more than the state had fixed by a tariff. And yet the conditions of service were at times better after war than 100 years later. The farm servants of Silesia had, in 1652, meat twice a week, whilst even in our century, districts are known where they have it only 3 times a year. Further, wages after the war were higher than in the following century. G. Freytag. End of footnote. George II extended the laws against coalitions of labourers to manufactures. In the manufacturing period par excellence, the capitalist mode of production had become sufficiently strong to render legal regulation of wages as impracticable as it was unnecessary. But the ruling classes were unwilling, in case of necessity, to be without the weapons of the old arsenal. Still, 8 George II forbade a higher day's wage than 2 shillings and 7 pence halfpenny, for journeymen tailors in and around London, except in cases of general mourning. Still, 13 George III, chapter 68, gave the regulation of the wages of silk weavers to the justices of the peace. Still, in 1706, it required two judgments of the higher courts to decide whether the mandates of justices of the peace as to wages held good also for non-agricultural labourers. Still, in 1799, an Act of Parliament ordered that the wages of the Scotch miners should continue to be regulated by a statute of Elizabeth, and two Scotch Acts of 1661 and 1671. How completely in the meantime circumstances had changed is proved by an occurrence unheard of before in the English Lower House. In that place, where for more than 400 years laws had been made for the maximum, beyond which wages absolutely must not rise, Whitbread in 1796 proposed a legal minimum wage for agricultural labourers. Pitt opposed this, but confessed that the condition of the poor was cruel. Finally, in 1813, the laws for the regulation of wages were repealed. They were an absurd anomaly, since the capitalist regulated his factory by his private legislation, and could, by the poor rates, make up the wage of the agricultural labourer to the indispensable minimum. The provisions of the labour statutes as to contracts between master and workman, as to giving notice and the like, which only allow of a civil action against a contract-breaking master, but on the contrary permit a criminal action against a contract-breaking workman, are to this hour, 1873, in full force. The barbarous laws against trades unions fell in 1825, before the threatening bearing of the proletariat. Despite this, they fell only in part. Certain beautiful fragments of the old statute vanished only in 1859. Finally, the Act of Parliament of June the 29th, 1871, made a pretense of removing the last traces of this class of legislation by legal recognition of trades unions. But an Act of Parliament of the same date, an Act to amend the criminal law relating to violence, threats, and molestation, re-established, in point of fact, the former state of things in a new shape. By this parliamentary escamotage, the means, which the labourers could use in a strike or lockout, were withdrawn from the laws common to all citizens and placed under exceptional penal legislation, the interpretation of which fell to the masters themselves in their capacity as justices of the peace. 2 years earlier, the same House of Commons and the same Mr. Gladstone, in the well-known straightforward fashion, brought in a bill for the abolition of all exceptional penal legislation against the working class. But this was never allowed to go beyond the second reading, and the matter was thus protracted until at last the great Liberal Party, by an alliance with the Tories, found courage to turn against the very proletariat that had carried it into power. Not content with this treachery, the great Liberal Party allowed the English judges, ever complacent, in the service of the ruling classes, to dig up again the earlier laws against conspiracy and to apply them to coalitions of labourers. We see that only against its will and under the pressure of the masses did the English Parliament give up the laws against strikes and trades unions, after it had itself, for 500 years, held, with shameless egoism, the position of a permanent trades union of the capitalists against the labourers. During the very first storms of the Revolution, the French bourgeoisie dared to take away from the workers the right of association but just acquired. By a decree of June the 14th, 1791, they declared all coalition of the workers as an attempt against liberty and the Declaration of the Rights of Man, punishable by a fine of 500 livres, together with deprivation of the rights of an active citizen for 1 year. Footnote. Article 1 of this law runs, as the abolition of any form of association between citizens of the same estate and profession is one of the foundations of the French Constitution, it is forbidden to re-establish them under any pretext or in any form, whatever they might be. Citizens belonging to the same profession, craft, or trade have joint discussions and make joint decisions with the intention of refusing together to perform their trade, or insisting together on providing the services of their trade or their labours only at a particular price, then the said deliberations and agreements shall be declared unconstitutional, derogatory to liberty and the Declaration of the Rights of Man, etc. Felony, therefore, as in the old labour statutes. Révolution de Paris, Paris, 1791. End of footnote. This law, which, by means of state compulsion, confined the struggle between capital and labour within limits comfortable for capital, has outlived revolutions and changes of dynasties. Even the Reign of Terror left it untouched. It was but quite recently struck out of the penal code. Nothing is more characteristic than the pretext for this bourgeois coup d'état. Granting, says Chapelier, the reporter of the Select Committee on this law, that wages ought to be a little higher than they are, that they ought to be high enough for him that receives them to be free from that state of absolute dependence due to the want of the necessaries of life, and which is almost that of slavery. Yet the workers must not be allowed to come to any understanding about their own interests, nor to act in common, and thereby lessen their absolute dependence, which is almost that of slavery. Because, forsooth, in doing this they injure the freedom of their ci-devant masters, the present entrepreneurs. And because a coalition against the despotism of the quondam masters of the corporation is, guess what, is a restoration of the corporations abolished by the French Constitution. Footnote. Boucher et Roux. Histoire parlementaire. End of footnote. Chapter 29. Genesis of the Capitalist Farmer. Now that we have considered the forcible creation of a class of outlawed proletarians, the bloody discipline that turned them into wage labourers, the disgraceful action of the state, which employed the police to accelerate the accumulation of capital by increasing the degree of exploitation of labour, the question remains, whence came the capitalists originally? For the expropriation of the agricultural population creates, directly, none but the greatest landed proprietors. As far, however, as concerns the genesis of the farmer, we can, so to say, put our hand on it, because it is a slow process, evolving through many centuries. The serfs, as well as the free small proprietors, held land under very different tenures, and were therefore emancipated under very different economic conditions. In England, the first form of the farmer is the bailiff, himself a serf. His position is similar to that of the old Roman villicus, only in a more limited sphere of action. During the second half of the 14th century, he is replaced by a farmer, whom the landlord provided with seed, cattle, and implements. His condition is not very different from that of the peasant. Only he exploits more wage labour. Soon he becomes a métayer, a half-farmer. He advances one part of the agricultural stock, the landlord the other. The two divide the total product in proportions determined by contract. This form quickly disappears in England to give the place to the farmer proper, who makes his own capital breed by employing wage labourers, and pays a part of the surplus product in money or in kind, to the landlord as rent. So long, during the 15th century, as the independent peasant and the farm labourer working for himself as well as for wages enriched themselves by their own labour, the circumstances of the farmer and his field of production were equally mediocre. The agricultural revolution, which commenced in the last third of the 15th century and continued during almost the whole of the 16th, excepting, however, its last decade, enriched him just as speedily as it impoverished the mass of the agricultural people. Footnote. Harrison, in his description of England, says, "Although peradventure 4 pounds of old rent be improved to 40, toward the end of his term, if he have not 6 or 7 years' rent lying by him, 50 or 100 pounds, yet will the farmer think his gains very small." End of footnote. The usurpation of the common lands allowed him to augment greatly his stock of cattle, almost without cost, whilst they yielded him a richer supply of manure for the tillage of the soil. To this was added in the 16th century a very important element. At that time, the contracts for farms ran for a long time, often for 99 years. The progressive fall in the value of the precious metals, and therefore of money, brought the farmers golden fruit. Apart from all the other circumstances previously discussed, it lowered wages. A portion of the latter was now added to the profits of the farm. The continuous rise in the price of corn, wool, meat, in a word, of all agricultural produce, swelled the money capital of the farm without any action on his part, whilst the rent he paid, being calculated on the old value of money, diminished in reality. Footnote. On the influence of the depreciation of money in the 16th century, on the different classes of society, see A Compendium of Brief Examination of Certain Ordinary Complaints of Divers of Our Countrymen in These Our Days, by W.S. Gentleman, 1581. The dialogue form of this work led people for a long time to ascribe it to Shakespeare, and even in 1751 it was published under his name. Its author is William Stafford. In one place, the knight reasons as follows. Knight, you, my neighbour, the husbandman, you, Master Mercer, and you, Goodman Cooper, with other artificers, may save yourselves mightily well. For as much as all things are dearer than they were, so much do you arise in the price of your wares and occupations, that ye sell again. But we have nothing to sell, whereby we might advance ye price thereof, to countervail those things that we must buy again. In another place, the knight asks the doctor, I pray you, what be those sorts that ye mean, and first of those that ye think should have no loss thereby? Doctor, I mean all those that live by buying and selling, for as they buy dear, they sell thereafter. Knight, what is the next sort that ye say would win by it? Doctor, marry, all such as have takings of farms in their own manurance, cultivation, at the old rent, for where they pay after the old rate, they sell after the new. That is, they pay for their land good cheap, and sell all things growing thereof dear. Knight, what sort is that which ye said should have greater loss hereby than these men had profit? Doctor, it is all noblemen, gentlemen, and all other that live either by a stinted rent or stipend, or do not cultivate the ground, or do occupy no buying and selling. End of footnote. Thus they grew rich at the expense both of their labourers and their landlords. No wonder, therefore, that England, at the end of the 16th century, had a class of capitalist farmers, rich, considering the circumstances of the time. Footnote. In France, the régisseur, steward, collector of dues for the feudal lords during the earlier part of the Middle Ages, soon became an homme d'affaires, who, by extortion, cheating, etc., swindled himself into a capitalist. These régisseurs themselves were sometimes noblemen. For example, this is the account given by Monsieur Jacques de Torres, knight and lord of a manor near Besançon, to the lord who administers the accounts at Dijon for His Highness the Duke and Count of Burgundy, of the rents appurtenant to the above-mentioned manor, from the 25th day of December 1359 to the 28th day of December 1360. Alexis Montei, Traité de Matériaux Manuscrit, etc. Already it is evident here how in all spheres of social life the lion's share falls to the middleman. In the economic domain, for example, financiers, stock exchange speculators, merchants, shopkeepers skim the cream. In civil matters, the lawyer fleeces his clients. In politics, the representative is of more importance than the voters, the minister than the sovereign. In religion, God is pushed into the background by the mediator, and the latter again is shoved back by the priests, the inevitable middlemen between the good shepherd and his sheep. In France, as in England, the great feudal territories were divided into innumerable small homesteads, but under conditions incomparably more favourable for the people. During the 14th century arose the farms, or terriers. Their number grew constantly, far beyond 100,000. They paid rents, varying from one-half to one-fifth of the product, in money or in kind. These farms were fiefs, sub-fiefs, etc., according to the value and extent of the domains, many of them only containing a few acres. But these farmers had rights of jurisdiction in some degree over the dwellers on the soil. There were four grades. The oppression of the agricultural population under all these petty tyrants will be understood. Montaigne says that there were once in France 160,000 judges, where today 4,000 tribunals, including justices of the peace, suffice. End of footnote. Chapter 30. Reaction of the Agricultural Revolution on Industry. Creation of the Home Market for Industrial Capital. The expropriation and expulsion of the agricultural population, intermittent but renewed again and again, supplied, as we saw, the town industries with a mass of proletarians entirely unconnected with the corporate guilds and unfettered by them. A fortunate circumstance that makes old A. Anderson, not to be confounded with James Anderson, in his History of Commerce, believe in the direct intervention of Providence. We must still pause a moment on this element of primitive accumulation. The thinning out of the independent, self-supporting peasants not only brought about the crowding together of the industrial proletariat, in the way that Geoffrey Saint-Hilaire, in his Notion de Philosophie Naturelle, Paris, 1838, explained the condensation of cosmical matter at one place by its rarefaction at another, but in spite of the smaller number of its cultivators, the soil brought forth as much or more produce after as before, because the revolution in the conditions of landed property was accompanied by improved methods of culture, greater cooperation, concentration of the means of production, etc., and because not only were the agricultural wage labourers put on the strain more intensely, a point that Sir James Stuart emphasises, but the field of production on which they worked for themselves became more and more contracted. With the setting free of a part of the agricultural population, therefore, their former means of nourishment were also set free. They were now transformed into material elements of variable capital. The peasant, expropriated and cast adrift, must buy their value in the form of wages from his new master, the industrial capitalist. That which holds good of the means of subsistence holds with the raw materials of industry dependent upon home agriculture. They were transformed into an element of constant capital. Suppose, for example, a part of the Westphalian peasants, who at the time of Frederick II all span flax, forcibly expropriated and hunted from the soil, and the other part, that remained, turned into day labourers of large farmers. At the same time arise large establishments for flax spinning and weaving, in which the men set free now work for wages. The flax looks exactly as before, not a fibre of it is changed, but a new social soul has popped into its body. It forms now a part of the constant capital of the master manufacturer. Formerly divided among a number of small producers who cultivated it themselves, and with their families spun it in retail fashion, it is now concentrated in the hand of one capitalist, who sets others